Welcome, folks, to episode 3610 of the Survival Podcast. Today's episode is called Mega Fires from a Permaculture Perspective. The guest that I'm going to have on with me in just about 5 minutes from here is a gentleman named Matthew Trum. He is he's a permaculturist and regenerative systems educator, designer, consultant, and speaker. He is the founder of an organization called Treetop Permaculture. Really interesting guy. I've done a lot of research on him since I got his app. And you might be thinking, hey, we're going to talk about fires with this permaculture guy today because of all the fires in California. That would be both true and false. We're going to talk about it because of fires in California, but not the ones on your TV right now. This gentleman's been through some of those fires in California. He has an informed perspective on what's going on out there because he actually lives there, unlike a lot of experts on California that live in, like, Virginia or whatever, and we're going to talk about this through the permaculture lens, as in why it happens and what can be done to either prevent and or at least mitigate it, and I think this is a really important discussion. My personal opinion is this type of thinking, not necessarily exactly what we're going to say, but branching off from this type of thinking, is literally the only thing that can be done to address this problem in California. People keep saying not to make it political. That's interesting because both sides are saying not to make it political, and the next thing they do is make it political, even though both sides have some points. The answer probably is let's examine the reason and the cause and address what we can and figure out what we can address, and then what we can address, plan for that problem. That would be systems thinking, i.e. permaculture thinking, and permaculture thinking almost always one way or another involves water. And water, of course, is one of the big parts to the solution. We'll be talking about all of that and more in just a bit. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Hey, water, you got to drink it, not just put fires out with it. And a lot of you guys are drinking some water that has some stuff in it, and maybe it shouldn't. And you never know when it gets worse. And because when they tell you, hey, you know, we're under a boil water advisory, you know what that usually means? It means some people got sick, went to the ER, and eventually they figured out that there was a problem, and they told you to boil your water, but you were just drinking it for the last week while stuff was in it you didn't want to be drinking. You see how that works? Berkey water filters are the way to go. They are incredibly affordable in their cost over time. In fact, they're one of the lowest cost systems out there that's also highly effective the way that they are. But you want to get your Berkey filtration systems from the Berkey guy. Jeff Gleason has been sponsoring this show since 2010. It's 2025. You want to do some math on that and see how long that is in the world of podcasting? It's forever. Most podcasts are not 15 years old, let alone have a sponsor with them that long. You can find everything from Jeff at usaberkeyfilters.com. And if you're an MSB member, there's a discount available for you in the MSB. Next up today, JM Bullion. You guys know I'm a Bitcoin bull. That'll never change. I will always be stacking sats. But I've also stacked a lot of silver and gold in my time, and specifically more silver than gold. Silver and gold have an ancient history of being monetary instruments. They ain't going anywhere anytime soon. They're a great wealth assurance program. I've always recommended about 5 to 10% of your net worth in precious metals. But why JM Bullion? Well, they sponsor the show you love. They give a discount to MSB members. I'm not even aware of anybody else doing that, by the way. A discount on precious metal is very unusual because the margins are so low to begin with. They have free shipping, and if there ever is an issue, I have a direct line to the president of the company. I've been approached by other silver and gold dealers, and when I've asked for that type of treatment, I've been told no, and I've told them to go away. And I knew they'd say no, and that's why I asked for it, so I don't have to have two people sponsoring the same thing, and that way there's no conflict over mind share. Anyway, JM Bullion is a great partner. These are people been with us since, I think, 2013. That's over 10 years at this point. It's 12 years in the world of podcasting, man. Check out JM Bullion, great partner, been with us, again, a very long time. With that, let's go ahead and bring our special guest, Matthew Trum, on. Matthew, welcome to the show, brother.
Hey, thank you so much, Jack. It's an honor and pleasure.
I'm glad to have you with us. Before we dig into this very timely topic, and I don't remember exactly when you put your guest form in, but it was definitely before all this kicked off.
Yeah.
It just kind of worked out that we hit right in the middle of it. Fortuitous for the audience and infortuitous for the, people that live in California, unfortunately. Before we dig into that, though, let's talk about you, man. How did you end up in the world of permaculture? Like, what were you doing pre-permaculture? Because most of us don't pop out of mama and I'm a permaculturist. There's some path that leads us to that world.
Yeah, man. Well, it's funny because actually, well, when I grew up in the Bay Area, I was like totally disconnected to, where our food comes from, all the, everything pretty much as far as the environment and all that, right? I was more of a street kind of kid. I was into like hip hop. I actually was a DJ since I was like 13 till I was about 25 years old. I was a hip hop DJ and was like going to clubs and stuff and doing things like that. So totally different world. I think I hit my kind of truth movement sort of awakening, I would say, somewhere around, 2003-ish, something like that. And so I started down the road of, and you know, background, my brother was in the military. Two of my brothers, my dad was in the military. So I was very much like, steered towards, I was going to join the military. I wanted to be a special ops guy, like all these kind of, things, these ideas when you're a kid. And I actually went to like a Marine camp called Devil Pups when I was, in high school. Cause I went to the recruiter's office and like wanted to join, and they said, you're too young, kid, but there's this thing. And so I was like, that was my mindset. And then when I was still doing the hip hop thing, mostly after that. And then, I ended up like into the survival, mindset, and prepper mindset. Right. So I was going down that rabbit hole. And, when my family's, land, so we bought this land up in the mountains here above Oroville, which is Northern California, a little, northeast of Sacramento. People aren't familiar with the area near Chico, and of course Paradise is the name that everybody will know after 2018, the campfire. So we had land 12 acres up in the mountains, and I moved up there because my folks were like at the point where they were thinking about selling it, and I said, I'd be down to go up there. And I was getting into all this survival stuff. And so it was more like, let's bury some food and, have a bunker and like go up in the mountains and, and sort of have a survival base camp. Right. And very much after that, I started going and thinking about growing food. Cause obviously, I can't just store food forever, so I started getting into growing food, always was organic, and through research found food forestry, and thought, wow, this makes a lot of sense, started getting really into that. And then I found this word permaculture and started going down that rabbit hole and was like, wow, this is kind of like the holy grail of this meaningful thing that I've been looking for. It kind of tied in a lot of different elements of what I've been into in my past, but it was like taking the survival and making it, I call it survival, and how to apply that, in that way. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Interesting, man. I think a lot of people have similar stories. They're never the same, but they're always about beginning to question the reality that's put in front of us and then realizing that we're not as safe and secure as we think we are, and then taking some path. Some go kind of prepper first, some go straight into like regen ag or permaculture, but it seems like everybody that takes the walk ends up at least into some level of a permaculture, organic gardening, because of exactly what you said. You start to realize, like, no matter how much I put away for myself, I really can't do this forever. What I need to do is have a way that I can take care of myself now that will continue to work even if things go sideways. And so it's amazing to me how many people end up in that same spot. Let's start talking though about these fires. There's a lot of blame game pointing going on, and some of it I think is actually valid. But, I mean, you live out there. This isn't a big topic to you. This is something you're not thinking about because it showed up on TV 2 days ago. You're thinking about it because you deal with it, and you have dealt with it. What do you think the biggest contributing factors are causing these fires to be mega fires that not only start and happen but become so hard to control?
Yeah. Well, let me be clear about something. You know, I'm not a believer in the anthropogenic, global warming or climate change narratives. But what I do believe in is localized microclimate effects, and I do believe, just like in the permaculture sector's analysis, we know that energy, right, like ecosystems and structures and our placement of elements affect the energies of the climate energies around us. Okay, so what I believe is contributing factors over the course of the last 100 years, mostly man-caused things that we've done, bad decisions, that were made in the past, had a compounding effect over time. And I think that we're starting to see that peak of the effects. And I think that the wind-driven fires are one of those massive peaks that we're seeing. Because essentially, when you have a climate that it historically obviously had fire forever, what's the difference, right, between what the fires that happened in the historical past and these current fires? I would say, number one, without any other ecological stuff talking about that, is placement of elements, human structures and the thoughtful placement and connection between elements. And you said it in the beginning of the podcast, water, right, is mm-hmm. like the number one. And some of those ecological effects that we could talk about are compounding effects that are ultimately water is the loser in the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things. One, like you said, the water issue and all. I think that the overall forest management, what I've seen, having been to California a number of times over the last 20 years, is abysmal. Yeah. Like I think the people doing it are largely incompetent, but I think they have in their heads they're doing it for a reason. Yeah. There is this idea that nature should be untouched. And the problem with that, if you're also going to live surrounded by nature, is the fire cycle is a natural phenomenon, right? As I'm building right now a course on biochar, and I have an entire chapter of that course that's on the natural fire cycle and the ecological role it plays. Like all those beautiful redwoods out there, a lot of them, certain species, they cannot even germinate new seed unless they're exposed to fire, right? Unless they're exposed to smoke.
Right.
And yet we have all this dry tinder laying everywhere. And I think when you point that out, there's a lot of people, again, that I don't think they've ever stepped foot in a dry climate, right? Some people in West Coast, people like really rainy parts of Oregon or Washington State, they say, oh, we do that here. We don't have anywhere near. Yes, because it rains there. Dry wood burns really, really hot, really, really fast. I think another contributing factor that's like there's not much that can be done about this other than mitigation strategies as a whole. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that have seen fire have never seen fire in the mountains. And this is a very different thing than fire on a plane. Wind too. You got Santa Ana winds and all that. But in general, fires moving down a mountainside move relatively slowly relative to how they move up a hill.
Yeah.
And once that fire gets to the bottom of a valley and starts climbing the other elevation, since flames go up, and if it gets driven by wind, it is insane
right. What
can happen. And I think another thing people don't get is I've seen a lot of the conspiracy theory shit, and we'll probably dig a little bit into it today anyway, about, it's space lasers or some stupid crap. This has been going on for as long as recorded history can see it. But one of the things I'll say is, well, these trees are here and this house burned down. And I'm like, have you never tried to make a campfire with green wood before? Like, I remember one of Bill Mollison's lectures on this very subject, and he said, you know, one of the best things that you can plant as a firebreak is walnut trees. And, yeah, of course, the whole class laughs at him. He says, really? Go. There's one outside. Go get your big lighter. Go out there and light it on fire. See how long you can sit there before your lighter melts. And so it is not living trees that make up at least the initial, like if you get anything hot enough, it'll burn.
Right.
But that's not what's really, it's snags, it's dried out, it's standing dead, it's stuff laying on the ground. To me, that's the fuel that's building these fires, at least initially.
Yeah, and let me be clear too, I didn't mention forest management, which is, I feel it's like a no-brainer, obviously.
Yeah.
But it's the compounding effects that are part of that forest management. So we've essentially, we've given most of the forest management up to, you know, to these logging companies, essentially. You know, even the U.S. Forest Service or the Cal Fire. Cal Fire, I think, is like 50% now of the state is running the forests of California, and then the U.S. Forest Service. And, you know, and again, logging's not bad. It's not what you do. It's how you do it. Logging is great if it's done properly. Mm-hmm. But then also you have a situation which the economy changed and oil prices changed dramatically. So it used to be cheap to go and log and use trucks to move it off the mountain and do all these things. Well, and then as the diesel prices went up, then it became very expensive for these logging companies to come and log their stands. So there was like all these stands and, you know, again, lots of bad practices. I think one of the big things that we will learn over time is that we not only logging the old growth tree, the largest trees, and not leaving the canopy, and we would have had sustainable understory logging for all of time. Yes, if we wouldn't have done that, you know, but that also, and you're talking about how that affected the mycorrhizal networks and all the other, you know, effects of that, the shade, the rain, everything, that was a massive thing. But then over time, as these logging companies would come back in, these they would actually not come and log for a very long period of time because it wasn't economically viable and they didn't want to deal with the regulations of the U.S. Forest Service. So they started buying their own land. So all of a sudden, all these logging companies started buying massive amounts of their own land, which is private land. They could do a little bit more what they wanted to do.
Sure.
But what happens in most of these areas, at least I'm going to talk about here, is that the regrowth, when you come and log and then just plant a very small diversity of trees, is that these weed trees, you know, pop up. And our primary weed tree here, I'll call it a weed tree, is the tan oak. And the tan oak, it just dominates these forests, especially if it's not managed at all. And so you're talking about, you have a tan oak that grows after these logging activities, maybe every 10 feet, 6 feet. I mean, no joke.
Okay.
And they're prime. And the, what they do is they actually create so much acidity to the top layer of the forest that nothing else wants to grow. And then they block out the sun. And then they're just complete. It's just a complete, basically dead understory.
Mm.
And so not only that, now your trees are saying, we always say, oh, trees are great. Trees are great. You know, have so many trees, you know, it's good for the water and everything like that. Well, there's an entropy to that.
Yeah.
So you get to a certain point. Now it's actually, it's pulling so much of the groundwater up, I should say the surface water that would be pooling and things like that. That's really important for wildlife. Now all of a sudden it's all in these trees. And people would blame it on the pot growers and all these kinds of things. And I'm going, no, look at all these pumps. You know, go walk into this forest. Look at all these pumps.
How much freaking pot would you have to grow to dry out 17,000 acres of wilderness?
Right.
Like when people say that, you're like, when you talk, do you hear yourself? Do you know what you've said? Do you put do you put anything you say under like the mental microscope at any point? Because that is such, I've not heard that one, but I've heard similar nonsense out here. You know, it's the autumn olives. Like you can't even, now, unlike what you're talking about, there are autumn olives around here. There's not a lot. You can't find one if you go 10 foot in the woods. Mm-hmm. It's an edge species. Eleagus, right. It wants, if you put it in the middle of a field, the sun will kill it in Texas. Right. And if you put it 100% in the shade will kill it. It has this very small edge that it can fit in, and yet it gets blamed for shit that it can't possibly do. Right. And so I've not heard that one, but on the other side of it, as ridiculous as it is, it doesn't surprise me.
People want to jump and blame something. And
one thing. Yeah. Right? That's the big thing.
Right. And especially with these fires, you know. I mean, people are going to be quick to jump onto something. And I understand it, you know, in a certain sense, like, you know, Campfire Paradise, PG&E had a bad transformer. I understand this, but we all are, you know, we all want power. We all wanted cheap power. And I will say that although their fault for that particular transformer, the conditions, were set no matter what. So whether it was a cigarette butt outside, thrown out the window, whether it was a chain sparked on the ground, it would have happened, you know, one way or the other. So it's just a matter of circumstance, you know, that one thing or the other. So, but we quick to blame, but it's not going to fix the problem.
No. And you, like, the genesis of the individual fire is important, but yet it also, like you're saying, this is what I've been trying to say. It will happen.
Right.
If you take away all the people and you do absolutely nothing, sooner or later, you're going to have a lightning strike or something like that. And you're going to, and when you take away people, your fires end up being way more catastrophic. I've spent a lot of the last about 4 years digging deep into how Native peoples managed things in North America. And their number one tool was fire. Mm-hmm. These people understood fire at a level that we do not understand today in any way, shape or form. They burned all the time, but they also had like when initial settlers got here, they described the wilderness as park-like. Mm-hmm. So you know what that means. You have giant trees,
right,
but very little understory except in edges and in glades.
Right.
And if you go into the wilderness today, it doesn't look anything like that unless it's mature enough wilderness and it's in a humid climate where the understory that does happen tends to break down rapidly, you might get that.
Right.
But when you go into a brittle ecosystem like the West Coast of the United States, where you've got like this weird mashup of almost like boreal forests in the north meeting Mediterranean forest in the south, that's not how that works anymore.
Right. And it's a much different system, you know. So one of the things that I've been working on, I'm actually putting together a little book about this, is the element analysis essentially of all the contributors of the forest tenders, you know. Mm-hmm. Because so one of the misnomers I want to say would be that like that the natives managed all the forest or something, you know.
No,
like,
no.
They burned very, very you know, frequently in the areas where they dwelt, you know,
where they dwelled, where they hunted and where they farmed.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And they had their patterns and they'd go in certain, but the idea that they managed like this vast, mountains, but there was many others that were tending those, and that were the creatures that were, mm-hmm. Part of these forests and the old growth trees, the beavers, we don't think about all those things. Like we talk about management, like the idea that humans again could manage, even with our mechanical, you know, powers, everything that we have today, you know, heavy equipment, mastication, et cetera. The idea that we can manage all the forests is insane when we have, just like, you know, we know in permaculture, like, why are we going to do all the work when we could have other elements do most of that work for us, you know? And so we have to understand what are the functions of those missing these elements and ones that are not there anymore. Because if we understand what the functions of these elements are, we can then think about how can we mimic those elements at the same time as bringing those elements back in. So grazers, like biggest thing ever, right? The grazers. We had a Serengeti of grazers here in California from the valley and up into the foothills. Now people say, oh, like a lot of these animals like didn't go very high up into the mountains. But the thing is that we had a lot more meadow in the mountains.
Yes.
So they actually did travel up into the mountains.
Yeah. Tell an elk hunter that large grazers don't go up in the mountains.
Right.
And he'll show you his calves and tell you how retarded you are. I'm sorry. Like, that's just nonsense.
Right. And so, you know, you got to imagine. So when the fires would come through, now you have all this regrowth, right? And so that's when these masses of grazers would come through, and they're using that same technique, right? Because there's predator pressures, right? So they're going into a place all at one time, mowing down everything, and they're doing it all in equal pace, right? Just like the holistic grazing methods that we know about. And so they're able to just move. They're not destroying the larger trees. They're not girdling the bigger trees that survive these fires that have been there historically. But when, like, the tan oak is the best example, like when a fire happens, tree burns down because these are so hot, but it regrows. Instead of one, there's like 200 new, you know, it's like a bush, right? And so when that tree initially grows out, when it's still herbaceous and very young, that's when the grazers would have come through. They would have mowed down most of those trees, and then, you know, or the regrowth of that tree, and they would have dropped all this nutrient, feeding the microbes, doing all this amazing stuff. And now you have one or two leaders on this tree rather than this mass of, and that's what creates this brush problem. So, and you can go all the way up, you know, for every element, you know, whether it's the grazers, the beavers, the lack of salmon inputs from, you know, because we have these dams now and that the salmon don't get up in the woods, the lower numbers of bears not pulling the salmon in to the forest. I mean, where else do you get ocean nutrient, you know, into these forests? It just is non-existent anymore. So,
yeah. And I just looked up tan oak. I wasn't familiar with the plant. And it's an evergreen, and it reminds me a lot of trees we have out here, like post oak and live oak. Mm-hmm. And one thing, I just said living trees will stand through flames a lot of the time, but what I'll tell you about evergreen oaks from my experience is when flames hit their green leaves, that shit burns like it's got gasoline on it. It goes kind of crazy when it goes up. And if you've got a bunch of low shrubby versions of a tree like that, I mean, I didn't know that at all. Somebody mentioned eucalypts as well, and I know you have some parts of California where they've invaded, and that's the same type of thing. It's got a very highly flammable sap on eucalypts, and it's a low-grade wood, which means once it is exposed to heat, like I've seen, you know, trees in California that have clearly been through fires that happened 1,000 years ago.
Right.
And they have bark this thick on them, and you can't scrape through the charring, and the tree's happy.
Mm-hmm.
But a tree like that will just go up hard.
Well, when you look in a healthy forest system, which there's not many of them around, but our modern version of a healthy forest, the tan oak, like you were saying with your autumn olives, they don't persist in that kind of a system. They're just on the edges and so forth. The problem is the some of these bad logging practices that have happened is, you know, these 20 acre clear cut, you know, and what happens when they do that is you get it turns it back to a more of a chaparral environment, and tan oaks are the leader in that situation. They're always the winner because there's if you see their trees, I mean, they're just the acorns. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of acorns per tree. So they're a numbers game, right? The tan oak is a number. It's one of those, you know,
it's an R strategy.
Pioneer,
right?
Yeah, pioneer, you know, kind of biomass boom, which in a healthy system, right, where you had the grazers that would be able to come in after that, you're talking about nutrient drop.
Yeah.
Right. So in the long term cycles of nature, it's like, okay, bring a bunch of food out. Grazers come in, boom, drop a bunch of nutrients. Now it brings the succession to a higher evolutionary
succession. And if those that germinate, you get 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 will actually be in the success, you know, semi-mature forest. Where now you're getting like 100%, they're dominating everything else, is what you're saying.
And it's even though that those loggers planted all their timber trees in there, but the tan oaks overpower.
Yeah.
And they might come back and they might spray, they might do some kind of selection, you know, to try to select it, but they're only going to do it right around where their trees are. And they don't care about any of that, but now they're having different strategies, not because they're, you know, people are thinking like, oh, I want to save the chipmunk or something, but they're doing it because it actually now economically isn't viable. You know, so they are planning different strategies. I also have to say, I think one of the biggest mistakes that was made in the past was the genetic selection, leaning so hard to the fast growth. What we saw is these trees that have been grown, the Doug firs, the different pines that were, you know, and it's through selection. It's not genetic modification, but through selection, they had these trees grow so fast that their cell walls are they were more open and more susceptible to the pine borer beetle and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think that greed, again, you know, it's just greed, you know, let's everything faster. Let's do bigger pieces of land when again, thinking about longer term harvesting, they could have been leaving the larger, you know, leaving more of the trees, which now we're turning to more of a what they call like a closed canopy harvesting.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's going to be a better way.
See, I think if we're going to look at this from a design and a system perspective, we have to understand something. You just used a word there, and I know you mean well by it, but it's probably not really the right word to come at it from a designer, and that's greed. Humans follow incentives.
Right.
So it doesn't matter whether it's greed or it's I'm trying to do good. Whatever the incentive is where if I'm a hunter and I'm hunting deer, and I've got a really wide bit of woods, and I've got a funnel that comes down and goes back out the other side. I'm going to set up in that funnel because the incentive for that deer is not to expose itself and to stay in cover. And this is a place that I can now use that funnel to get a shot with my bow, right? Really simple. That's the incentive that deer has. Stay in cover, but I got to move from A to B, so I'm going to go through the funnel.
Right.
So we have a whole system designed into the entire geography with the incentives out of whack.
Right.
The incentives are grow as many trees as you can, as fast as you can, harvest them and get money for them. Mm-hmm. That's it. So no matter what you say, no matter what I say, no matter how many laws, no matter how many regulations, if you don't address the incentive, it's like saying I have an erosion problem, but I don't want to put a swale in to stop it. Well, it may not be a swale. It may be gabions. But if you don't change the incentive for the water to funnel down that one spot, that's what it's going to do.
Right.
And I think that's one of the big problems we have. I think another problem we have is a misunderstanding of what the real problem ends up being. Yes, it sucks that somebody's house burned down. But you also see people right now cheering because XYZ fire is 100% contained, which doesn't mean it's out, by the way. It just means we've got it where it ain't going to spread and it'll burn itself out, which means a lot more loss. But the other side of it is once they tell you, woohoo, all the fires are out, that does not mean the problem's gone. And that's not just for the person that lost their home. The person's home is still standing. The whole landscape now is in a disturbance and a state of disarray. And the natural things that you've just spent 30 minutes talking about that normally would have aided in that recovery, if we don't address them since we get Seth Holzer, if you don't want pigs, you got to do the pig's job, right? If we don't have grazers, we're going to do the grazer's job. So what do people need to be thinking about when this is all over? And the landscape is destroyed, but for whatever reason, they can still live there. Like fixing this We've got soil contamination issues. We've got erosion issues. It doesn't rain until it rains. Like, this is like a desert, semi-desert environment, very arid. And designing in a desert is designing to a flood.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you have to design for the flood, even though you only get the flood once a year. And you know what's going to, you know what the spring's going to look like in California and LA County, mudslides. Right. That's right. What do we do about all that?
Yeah. Well, so that was the big part of how I got involved in the fires. After the campfire, which my daughter and her mother's house was burned down, in that fire. And so, you know, I actually dropped my daughter off that morning, you know, and fire's so usual, here.
I just want to hold you up just a second for some people. Yeah. I know there's people that they're hearing a word and it's not the campfire.
Yes.
Campfire. Yeah. Yeah. It was a very big fire like the ones you're looking at that happened, what, in 17 or 16 or
something? It was 2018. The town of Paradise was burned down. It was the most life lost in any fire. I know, at least in California, I think there was one other fire in the United States that had more life lost than that fire. But it was not even that big compared to the fires that were following that. But it was about 150,000 acres. It started in the canyons here, wind driven. And one day, you know, the entire town of Paradise, thousands and thousands of homes. I think about 50,000 people were displaced in the fire and everything. So. I saw the smoke that morning, dropped my daughter off at school up in Paradise. And by the time I got back down the hill, my phone was just blowing up. And, you know, told me about the fires and, you know, I couldn't get a hold of her. They put roadblocks. I couldn't even get to my child. Didn't know what happened for over an hour. So very close to home for me. She ended up getting taken out with some friends. Thank God, you know, and so after that, you know, I'm paying a lot of attention to everything. I start thinking about, you know, what's going to happen because there's rain coming, like in a week. They know there's a bunch of rain coming. And I'm like, what's going to happen with all this toxic material, you know, and from these homes and everything, not to mention the erosion and everything else. And I call up all these different agencies and stuff to see if there's a plan for it. Turns out there's no plan. You know, because of the idea of these mega fires is so new. And even though, like in this area, we're like probably the furthest ahead, 52%+. I mean, that was like old statistics, but like over 50% of Butte County, my county landmass has burned in 5 years, the entire landmass. And we're one of the biggest counties in California. You know, the following fire that burned my property in the mountains here, was 350,000 acres. And then the Dixie fire was 960,000 acres. And then this recent Park fire was like, it was up there. I think it was like 400,000, something like that. So, you know, we know about fire, but so we have strategies a little bit ahead of most places. There was no thinking behind this. So basically all this crap, and we're talking, we don't even know what is in these houses. We know that there's asbestos and lead and arsenic and all kinds of, volatile, you know, kind of PVC type chemicals and everything. It's off the charts, and we're starting just finally get in some of the data of what actually is in these homes, you know, and what's they've been collecting in the water and now in the biology of the animals that are downstream. But it's the kind of thing, I'll just say it this way, you can fix a lot of stuff, but once these heavy metals and things get into the environment, that's something, it's a compounding effect. It's called bioaccumulation, where it then gets in the fatty tissues of animals, mainly in fish. Ends up in fish, then it gets into the higher, you know, and then deer and everything else. And so you go hunting, you go fishing in these areas, you're getting a mass dose of heavy metals over time. So it's really important. We can't overlook it. And so I basically created a program to deal with it. And so we were doing it like we were going in with groups of people and just putting up what we call wattles, word that I wasn't even familiar with back then, but they're those straw noodles.
Okay.
Okay. So best thing people can do is put and hopefully, and we can do it through government agencies, but they're very incompetent with doing it, because we got that done and they did it all, a lot of it wrong. But I still have to give kudos for the county here. I found a guy who was working for the county who was hearing me. I had to go on news. I had to go on the news. I had to actually do a lot of the work myself. I sent out surveys to the community. People were really interested in it, you know, and they didn't know, the county wouldn't listen, but I had to go do that work and show it to them, go on the news. And then they finally called me. Okay. What do we need to do? And so you can get the local governments and then eventually the state governments, et cetera, to enact. And I have a protocol for it. I've been training other counties all over, went to the CZU fire in Santa Cruz, been to a lot of areas in California to teach them what I did and how they can get this pushed through. But you can do it yourself, right? So putting these wattles around your home, around your vehicles, as close as possible to those vehicles, and try to keep them on, you know, on contour or slightly off, you know, or slightly off level, you know, 1%, 2% grade. So that way, when it does rain, it contains that material. That's the best thing you can do. There is a new product, this company that I'm working with. Can't think of the name of the product at the moment, but it's basically like a gel material that can be sprayed on the houses and that basically contains the material, and actually is the best thing that I found now, because moving wattles and placing all these wattles, a lot of manual labor involved, and logistically, at least for up here, when you're dealing with like all these rural areas and access is really hard and everything, it's not feasible in a lot of places, but going and just spraying out this gel in a lot of places is actually really great, and it's non-toxic stuff. And I advised in Maui about that.
And I just want, for anybody that's in the video anyway, real quick, when you say wattles, so that they know what you're talking about, it looks something like that right there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if you're on audio only and you want to know what they look like, either Google it, or come by and look for about 42 minutes into the video today.
And even better than that is what's called a compost sock. Okay. And there's several companies. Company I've worked with, really awesome people, is called Filtrex, and they make these compost socks. Now, compost socks, it's basically just decomposed wood chips essentially that they use in it. Which I think is great, because you can make that locally. We've actually had compost. We've made our own compost sock machines and stuff, and made those on site in places. But they're the only thing that actually has scientific data backing up that it does actually prevent the different, like, because a lot of these chemicals and the, you know, these heavy metals are really colloidal, like, you know, small, and so it actually traps them, and it does remediate and hold those better than the straw wattles. And there was a lot of people doing like inoculation with mushrooms, you know, oyster mushrooms and things like that, that has been proven to help remediate, but the data is not great on that. It's really not actually great.
What can people do to keep their house from burning down in the first place? I mean, we can sit here and talk about, and I want to talk a little bit about what I would do if I was in control, which I'm not. If I was king of California, maybe I could get some shit done, but I'm not. But so you're stuck. You live in a place where this is a risk. You'd prefer for your property. A lot of people in this audience are like you and me. They have put their heart, their soul, and their life into their little piece of land. And it would be great if they didn't lose everything. So what are some strategies you can take on what you do control to try to save your place?
It's very similar things to what we already do in permaculture. But one thing, the number one thing to think about is built structures, right? What's the hottest thing that burns in these fires? Not the trees, it's the houses. In fact, I've seen places where the wood survived all around, but once the house catches on fire, all the trees around the house burn down. So the houses are the hottest things, and it has a lot to do with the materials we build our house with, the materials that are inside the homes. And so people that are rebuilding have to really think about what are you going to be building your house out of? That's massive. But water, number one thing is water. Obviously managing, if you have forest around you, managing, trees that you have, not having connecting layers, thinking about changing out, things from wood to something metal or, not wood, if you can. Water, rainwater catchment, massive. Any kind of earthworks that you can do to hold water. We used to get actually tax breaks for installing ponds in California. Now you have to pay taxes pay for permits and all this stuff to put in ponds and things like that.
Well, they think they're conserving water by not letting you hold it in a pond. And this is, anybody that understands like the hydrological cycles knows this is ridiculous. This makes no sense.
Yeah, obviously, and there's all those things I mentioned before, the missing elements of the forest that all contribute to the water holding capacity and the microorganisms, obviously, and, we all know about this. But, I live here, there's a flume system in this area, so we have ditch water. And these older systems that were put in the 50s and stuff, the best systems ever. They last forever. Minimal maintenance. They move water at a 1 to 2% grade around the entire area. Everybody in these areas has way more water. It's super cheap. We can literally leave a sprinkler on in many of these places for like less than $30 a month, all month long, and so we need to make more of these systems, but we can do these on our own properties. Larger rain catchment tanks, if you can. Think of your pool. So I always recommend people, I do consults, like, hey, you want a pool? Like, get an above ground swimming pool, pretty cheap. Yeah. That can be your winter storage and into summer. And as you go into summer, now you've got a fire, big fire.
Yeah, I want a 20,000 acre pond. We can't approve it. I want a 20,000 gallon pond. Can't do it. 24 foot round pool holds about 20,000 gallons.
Right. Now, a system I came up with is a rain catchment tank that then goes up to a sprinkler on the roof.
Okay.
Okay. Now, think about it. The water goes down on the roof, goes back into the rain catchment tank. And so it's just. Yeah. And so yeah. What happened, and you need an off grid, you need to have a generator. Generators, yep. Because they'll shut the power off first thing they do. So if you're on well and you don't have a lot of water storage, you don't have a backup, you got no water, So people like try to put on a sprinkler and then they leave and then the power gets shut off and now they have no water. But if you have a backup generator and you have a system like that, at least you can keep your house wet. But planting specific trees, like you mentioned, I have taken tons of documentation in Paradise right after the fire, went around what houses burned, what didn't, why. Irrigated trees, for one, and irrigated shrubs were like 75% less chance that they were going to ignite, and most of them survived. Things like bamboo placed in the right position that had been irrigated. I literally saw house burned, bamboo wall, fire goes over that next house. Placement of elements, super important. What kind of trees are you planting? So I disagree with the Cal Fire, some of the Cal Fire rules as far as like not having any vegetation next to your house. It's like, no, proper vegetation, but they don't,
You think so? Go try to light it with a lighter and see where you get.
But people are too dumb to think for themselves, Jack. That's the nanny state problem here in California.
It's bad everywhere, but there's some places it's worse than average. And bro, where you live, it's worse than average. There's no way around that at this point.
But more and more of this happens.
On the roof, I saw this system that looked pretty cool, and it was done with copper piping, and it basically had holes in the pipes and shot out to the side, and some of it landed on the roof and some went further to kind of protect the house. But it was what you said. All of the water that landed on the roof went back down into a cistern, and that cistern's what fed the system.
Right.
And you know, yeah, like you said, a generator, the beauty of a generator is it's a guarantee, but the amount of energy necessary for that lends itself well for resiliency to something like solar.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not going to run out of gas while you're gone and stop. I mean, that's like, if you have a generator that you have some sort of large capacity, like if you have, I don't know what they do about natural gas out there, but if it was natural gas from a utility, it's probably never going to stop. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a date. Now, do they shut it off? Because that's a whole flamethrower.
Well, redundancy, you know, redundancy and all these things. I mean, battery bank, I think for all this stuff is the best bet, because in a fire, you got massive amounts of smoke, so you're not going to get any solar really. So you got to have, you know, you got to have some backup batteries or something like that for sure.
If you have on a generator, if you have like a whole house generator, that's great, because it's going to turn on as soon as the power gets turned off. Right. you're back to, do you have enough fuel to keep it running long enough for it to be there? But I would think even if you've done that, even if it stops, the longer it runs, the more resilient the property is going to be when the fire actually gets there. And it was interesting to me, a lot of the politicians, including Newsom, were blaming homeowners who did some of these things for why they didn't have enough water, as though it's not because, like, you have a reservoir you drained. When I look at LA as a whole and I hear talk about water, there is something that it's not directly related. It's indirectly related to all these fire problems. There's a thing in my head that won't go away that I just don't want to hear it from these people. And that is the LA River, which isn't a river. It's a giant concrete system of drainage ditches that take every drop of water that lands in LA County and puts it in the Pacific as fast as possible.
Right.
And I'm thinking of all the money you spent. I don't remember how many tens of billions of dollars. They spent tens of billions of dollars on this monorail thing that doesn't connect anything on either end. Right. And I'm just going, how many concrete cisterns could you have installed in L.A. proper that would have caught all the water that went off of the roofs, the sidewalks, and the streets? Right. And all that water's in reserve. And you kind of – I always want to try to look at things where I'm not emotionally attached. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, if I'm an alien species in a flying saucer and I go to this place called California on this place called Earth, and I listen to all these people talk about their scarcity of water, and then I watch them spend millions of dollars. Today it would be billions because it's an old structure. Billions of dollars in value to create a ditch to make sure all the water goes into the ocean where it's salted and pumping it back really won't help anybody, right? Yeah. I would sit there and go, we're not ready to contact these people yet. They're not ready to know the larger world at this point. Like, they're either going to eliminate themselves or they're going to grow up. Like, right. I would never take that species seriously. It seems ridiculous, doesn't it?
Right. Well, and again, it's this compounding effect. And you have to, like, going back to what you said earlier, you have to have the incentives to do the right things. It's, you know, we must do these things from free will and to have that, you know, not through laws. And to do that, we must have incentive. One of the biggest things I could see, like, dealing with a lot of the forest management is you have to basically educate industries of what are the other products that can come out of these forests. A big one for me, like, you know, Europe is really good at this. They have a huge hardwood market. They have, there's so many things you can be doing with this hardwood. David Holmgren, I've been talking with David Holmgren recently through some Zoom meetings and stuff, and him and his son are working with Cal Berkeley on this new and we know about wood gasification yeah. units. They're working on these self propelled wood gasification chipper trucks, you know, so things like this. And it's funny that the, you know, one of the beginners of permaculture says the future is wood. And I said, man, I'm going to quote you on that, you know, but it's true. Like, we need to burn more wood, and we need to figure out how we can power. We need micro, scale, the facilities that burn the wood for energy,
yeah,
up in these mountains that could run lumber mills and things like that locally. And, there's so many ideas, but you know, it's like, we need to bring some of these people that already have tons of industries that have been created in Europe out here to educate, local and biochar and yeah, so many things, right? There's so many products that could be made, but it's just not known yet. And so we need, instead of saying these guys are the bad guys, you know, the loggers are the bad guys, or whoever's that, you know, people think it's this stream environmentalists, right, have to blame and then attack. It's like, yeah, no, we should actually be taking these folks who are people that love the mountains, that love, yeah, you know, and part of this, and love on them, and say, hey, how can we help you, you know, be educated to all these other possibilities? How can we use your heavy equipment to now start to build these flumes, to start to, you know, create these industries? And because, you know, logging, like, let's face it, like, there, a lot of the industry is dying, and we need wood, but there's a lot of other alternatives too. And yeah, so there's going to be a natural balance of, you know, of that lumber industry. And so, like, let's take some of that energy and let's put it towards some of the things that we need to do in by choice, you know, yeah, because they're educated, you know.
Yeah. And there's a whole incentive thing that, like, doesn't look like it's related, but it is. One would be like mortgage incentives, right? So here's an example. I have a very good friend, part of our community, named Tim, and he lives about 50 miles east of me. Been out to see his place. He has a monolithic dome home. He runs it 100% on solar. I was in there in August in freaking Texas, and one window unit cooled the whole thing. I was comfortable everywhere we went in his home, and I am not a person who's naturally comfortable with warm. I like to be 70 degrees. I like to be 68 if I can. So it's very low energy usage. If a fire hits that structure, it's going to roll right over it. It's not going to do anything. Somebody else in the community that owns one up in Oklahoma sent me a thing. It was a news story about his when it got trapped in a fire up there. And it said, monolithic dome home slightly scorched. That's literally what they published about the house. Here's the problem. Let's not even worry about California's crazy shit.
Yeah.
I found a house that looked an awful lot like one of those when I was ready to move down here. It had 7.5 acres. It was about $260,000. It was 5,000 square feet. The kitchen was probably worth more than they were asking for the house. And I'm like, I'll buy the damn thing. But you haven't even seen it. I don't give a shit. I'll buy it. My real estate agent says, well, here's your problem. You can't get an appraisal on it. Now, the city of Mansfield, for tax purposes, had no problem assessing the value and taxing it. Okay?
Right.
But a home inspector or appraiser, I should say, will pull comps. Yeah. And that's what has to go to the mortgage company. And the mortgage company says, but there's no comps because there are no other homes like this that have sold recently in the area, as though the shape of the house, instead of saying, okay, this house is this big, it has this much, just what a common sense for that won't be done. And that's nothing to do with California's lunacy. This is Texas.
Right.
Right. This is not even the government. This is the banking system's incentive. So how can I tell people you should be out there building monolithic domes as one example? And there's a lot of other structural homes we could be building, like hempcrete. Like, try it. Try to burn it. I dare you to burn it, right? Again, we're back to, can I get a builder loan? And then if I self-finance it, one thing any smart person thinks when they build a house, what is my exit strategy if I have to leave financially? Not how do I bug out, but how do I sell my house? Okay, I have to think about, can the buyer get a mortgage on my property? Mm-hmm. If the answer is no, I don't want to do it.
Right.
So, like, that's a whole other, like, we could be building structures that, yeah, we didn't fix the fire problem in of itself, but at least the house won't burn down.
Right.
I mean, have you ever seen a monolithic dome burn down? I have not. I'm sure in the exact right situation it could happen, but it is not likely.
Right. And we had straw bale homes in Paradise that survived the fire. I was super hopeful after the fire that, you know, okay, whole town burned down. Like, ears are going to be open to new ideas.
Look at what didn't burn down and say, kids, what's different about this, right?
Right. And, you know, yeah, we got a blank slate. Like, they're going to start being open to new ideas. Nope. Double down, you know, on the same old shit. Because, you know, I think it's like you had these – most of the people that were from there were baby boomers. You know, they didn't want something different. You know, they wanted the same thing. Actually, even double the size of a lot of these houses, you know. And what I thought was crazy is that, you know, after the fire, there was this whole debacle where they actually paid the cleanup crews per ton of the material that they brought out, the contaminated material. So they were digging like 4 foot, 5 foot holes in the ground where the houses were to get more tonnage, to get paid more. And, you know, which was its own travesty. But like, I was like, hey, you know, like you've got a basement in the waiting here, passive cooling, of the home, fire protection, on and on. You know, you could have the safe space where even you had to bug out of the house, you could then at least have your, you know, some stuff protected, right?
Yeah.
In the basement. You know, but no, nobody, they didn't want to, they all know that it's the cost of all this too much. We don't want basements. So they had to buy in dirt to fill all these holes, literally buying in material.
So somebody already excavated the hole for the basement.
Right.
Which is one of the big expenses of putting a basement in.
Right.
God willing that somebody would make me a hole for a basement here. It would require dynamite and like 30-ton excavators with the rock I have. But if I had the opportunity to have a basement, I don't care where I'm living. I'm not turning it down. It's cool when it's hot. It's warm when it's cold. It's stable. It's not going to burn. Like, because that would be another structure that could be applied is just simply earth contact in ground green roof structure that ain't burning either, baby.
We're in the hills here, so you know I love the, you know, the general principle of the earthship kind of models or whatever you want to call it. But passive heating, passive cooling, so many opportunities, the right kind of materials that don't burn, fire shutters on the windows, right? They have hurricane shutters in Florida. Why don't we have fire shutters? You know, because even if you built a house that's fireproof, like there's a place called the Rock House Restaurant, and it was made of rock. It's standing, but the entire inside is burned out because if it's hot enough, it goes through the window and everything inside is flammable. So, you know, fire shutters. I mean, I have a list of all this stuff. I've done presentations to all these places, but same answers, you know, mortgage companies. I mean, we could go a whole episode on this.
Yeah.
But it's the whole industry, you know, helping itself. All the way up from, you know, the appraisers and the real estate agents, the mortgage companies, the contractors, everything, you know, it's made that way. It's the planned obsolescence bullshit, whatever you want to call it, because all these materials that they use in the current home structures, we don't need a lot of that stuff anymore.
No.
It's total junk. But it's still being perpetuated because people are sitting on those jobs. It needs to be a massive re-education. You know, unfortunately, when places like LA burn like this, where there's a lot of attention, just like Paradise, that's where I was hopeful, because there was so much attention on that fire that, you know, hey, they're going to start listening, you know, to us, and there's this opportunity. Perhaps now that these really rich Hollywood stars and everything. Maybe there'll be some conversations about something different. I saw they had a guy on there that built these modular homes that are fireproof. Like he's calling them fireproof, which is a really most people don't say that because it's risky.
Fire resistant would be a better term from a lawyer standpoint, right?
Right, but he's actually saying no. These are 100% fireproof structures.
Yeah.
And so they put him on the news. I've seen some things like that. But, like, we've had all these things, you know. But, again, it's coming from that industry mindset. So they're like, how can we, you know, make them
– how can we commoditize this and get somebody else to pay for it?
That's, right.
But we're back to incentives. Like, in the end, what drives the incentives the most is that the politicians want to get reelected. That's the driving incentive. And the way a politician gets elected is two things. Make your opponent look worse than you. We call that the blame game. And you can criticize it all you want, but the purpose of the system is what it does. And that works for the politician. And the way that politician gets enough money to be able to, one that can yell the loudest and call their opponent the most names, is to make the people that give them money happy. The people that already have the money are part of the industrial system that causes all this shit. And so there is no way that that's going to change from top down. They will never change from top down. And all I can say is I don't know how many places have to have catastrophes like this happen, because it don't always have to be fire, with certain little bubbles and islands around it that remain unscathed before somebody goes, maybe we should ask the guy whose house is not burned down exactly why his house didn't burn down.
Right.
And maybe what he did is something we should try to figure out how to implement.
Right.
Now, that would be such a common sense approach. It's hard to understand why that's objected to until you go back to what I said in the beginning of what I just said. It is the incentive is get reelected and make the people with money happy.
Right.
And there is a scale of permanence in this, that if it's a 10 is a mountain, it's about a 9 because it's not the guy that sells the one thing. It's 20 industries linked together in a linear supply chain for the materials, the construction, the labor, the insurance, the financing.
The
those
permits.
The things.
Right.
Lock all of this up into a point of insanity. So you almost have to create this like groundswell of angry, unified people that start making the politician think, hey, if you don't listen, you might end up hanging from a light pole without being that direct about it. But the problem is I see two groups of people here of the general public. There's very few of us. We think there's more of us than there are because we all hang out together.
Yeah.
You've got people that are basically fuck the land, rape the land, let's clear cut everything, and then there won't be any fire because there won't be any trees.
Right.
Cut it all down and graze it, and then it'll be fine.
Deserts don't burn. Yeah.
Deserts don't burn. You got that much. And then you got the people that are like the complete eco-wacko hippies. And 40 minutes of set, I call myself a redneck hippie duck farmer, so not all hippies are bad. But their whole point is leave no trace, turn no leaf, leave everything alone. This place should be sealed off from man.
Yes.
Which is a big part of what caused this. How do you get those two groups of people to come together and be that groundswell? Because without that, we got nothing.
Well, that's where I feel it. That's where it's at, is, you know, and I think, you know, the conservative kind of movement right now has the opportunity to actually, you know, be the leader in this. I've tried to talk to my local, you know, representative here, Doug LaMalfa, about this a million times over the years. I'm like, dude, you could be leading like the regenerative kind of thing, because, you know, and it's education, you know, a lot of them don't understand. But it's saying, how can we, you know, look at this as benefiting these groups. Again, we have to like love on these industries and these people that I don't know if there's much hope for the extreme environmentalists, you know, other than they'll finally start to see the results of some of these things, in the positive way. But, you know, you have to meet in the middle. You have to be able to find, the incentive for those companies. I call it the transition economy, or the transition, the regeneration transition.
Yeah.
Like nobody can just, you know, flip a switch and change overnight, you know.
Yeah.
No commercial farmer can do that. You have to have a period of transition. And to do that, you know, my idea locally was like, okay, let's have these, you know, sort of, these, expos, you know, where we bring in all these, different industry, people from other places that are doing this and show the economy that's possible. Show how we can use, like I was saying, like the heavy equipment and the logging industry, like using the same infrastructures, the same skills, the same people right, to then do the better things, and how does it make money? You know, the whole thing with capitalism that is true, but then out of whack, is that selfish, you know, whatever you want to call it, incentive or selfishness, right? But where it's wrong is, you know, you don't have the connection element. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be part of an ecosystem, if you will, and it has to be part of that regenerative sort of loop. So you can be as selfish as you want, as long as you're actually connected to that regenerative mindset. Like, everything in nature essentially is selfish. They're not like symbiotic for the sake of they're thinking about, oh, I'm doing this for the benefit of the other things. They're taking advantage of a waste product from something else, and something else is taking advantage of that waste product. And they're all selfishly doing that, but they're doing it in a regenerative pattern. So we can educate these industries of how to be, you know, how to make money and how to thrive in these environments. It's just, we can't have, you know, pick the winners and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Well, can we, like, incentivize behavior that benefits everybody? So this is an actual picture. Mm-hmm. From LA County from about 5 years ago in the forest.
Yeah.
And anybody that's not looking at it, I'll kind of describe it. It is a massive shit ton of dead wood.
Yeah.
It actually was dropped probably by some level of conservation services or something. It was bucked, so it was cut into segments and lengths. There's a ton of slash with it. It's bone dry and it's laying all over the ground inside a forest. I can look at that even with the limited imagery. This came from one of my listeners. That is not a healthy forest. I can see that is not a healthy forest. Right. Now, where I grew up in Pennsylvania, it is a more temperate climate. I'll acknowledge that. Otherwise, I'm being disingenuous. But a lot of people heated with wood, whether they had a proper wood heating system or they simply had a fireplace. Wood was part of what they did. No one bought firewood unless they were just didn't want to do the work, or they were the kind of person had enough money to pay somebody else for it.
Right.
No one got a permit. The rules were pretty much don't cut a living tree and don't go anywhere you're not allowed to go. But if you can go there and you can get in there, you can have whatever you pick up off the ground, or if it's standing dead tree, it's okay to cut it down.
Right.
You never saw what I just showed you in any of the accessible parts of the woodlands anyway. Mm-hmm. And this was state game lands. It was national. It was, well, everything but it was state parks, not national parks. I don't know what the rules were there. But it was also a shitload of ton of land that was kind of like land that, you know, some coal company owned it that to cover their ass has been out of business for 100 years. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this coal company sold to that coal company that sold to that coal company that went bankrupt in 1952. Mm-hmm. Right. And there might be a gate there, but everybody had a key to it because somebody bumped it and threw a common lock on it. And no one bothered anybody that went up there. And the funny thing is, if you let people do that, the first wood that they take is all of that material that's closest to where people live, mm-hmm. which creates a buffer. Mm-hmm. And everybody I knew that used wood, that's where they got their wood. And everybody that went and got wood would get more than they needed. And they would, like, elderly neighbors and shit, you just give them some. But, yeah. You know, they would sell. Back then, a cord of firewood sold for about $80.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking the 80s. That was good money for just stuff you did in your spare time. And the incentive was, I get to heat my house for nothing. Right. I can make a little pocket money. And as long as I'm not cutting down living trees, no one's going to bother me. And my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't know California politics that well, that's not permitted out there because somebody might cut down a living tree. Now, anybody that knows anything about firewood, that if there is a lot of dead wood around, that would be the last thing you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You cut dead wood, as long as you put it somewhere dry, it's ready to burn.
Mm-hmm.
You cut green wood, what do you have to do with it?
You have to age it, yeah.
You have to age it. So who would do this?
Right.
This is not, and even if some, like, one person does it, they're not going to go cut down, like, the father of the forest or some shit in the middle of your redwood park. So they cut down one living tree by mistake. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
How many living trees are dead right now?
Right.
Because of these fires. So to me, there's all these types of incentives that people, and I almost don't know if they would work anymore, because since people no longer are allowed to do this, people no longer do this. Like, I learned that from my dad, who learned it from his dad, who learned it from my great grandfather.
Right.
Right. This was handed down. Like, this is what we do. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, be clear, we were not like, we all care so much about fire that we're going to go in the woods and clean up the debris.
Right.
There isn't a fire. It was, I need firewood.
Yeah.
And there it is, and it's free, mm-hmm. so I'm going to go do the work necessary to take it home.
Right.
And that's, I'm back to people follow incentives. So the incentive yeah. was right for that management practice.
Exactly. Yeah. So you must have a yield for everything you do, right? So yeah. that's one of the permaculture principles. And, you know, we have safe, proven systems, you know, whether it's the rocket mass heater systems. I mean, 90, you know, it uses what, a tenth of the wood. It, it has 90% of the emission, taken out of it. You know, so that like that right there, talk about safety. So it's a matter of education, you know, to, again, to local, code. I mean, it could be one that's done countrywide. Like we, okay, we know about this. We can make an industry standard for it. And we could have rocket mass heaters, not just in the rural areas, but we can have them even in the cities. You know, yeah. now we have a really big incentive to bring in all this wood in. We could be doing more of these, you know, wood gasification energy, systems, which a lot of this stuff is going to really come into play. Like the insurance companies, for one, they're at an entropy now where they have to think differently because they're not going to have a market. You know, pretty soon. And then on the other side of it, energy, you know, all these electric vehicles and stuff, the energy grids are already, and we haven't even kicked into nearly anything like that. We're already having rolling brownouts and blackouts in California all over the place. So obviously, and when we know heating and cooling our houses is like 60% of our energy uses in a household, we've got to come up with better ways to do that. So
and don't sit here and tell me about the CO2 released from burning wood and turn around and tell me ethanol is carbon neutral because that doesn't pass the biology or chemistry sniff test.
Right.
Right? You've got a word here that I love in your notes, native worship, white guilt syndrome in relation to restoration and stewardship roles, right? Like that's exactly what we're talking about yeah. there. Like we can't burn this wood because it's CO2. Well, here's 100,000 acres burning. Right. And I think it's hard for people to get their head around what that means, 100,000
right.
acres.
Right.
I hunt a ranch in South Texas called the West Kerr Ranch. It's 25,000 acres. I can't even grok the actual borders of it when I'm on it. And that's 25,000 acres.
Right.
You use some numbers like 900,000 acres burned in some of these situations.
Yeah.
My brain, and I've been on big land and I still can't grok that. And so I don't want to hear about Bill's CO2 from burning wood that was going to rot and release the CO2 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying that's how the chemistry works. Mm-hmm. In addition, like I agree, like rocket mass heaters and all that are great. But when we start talking about wood stoves, if you're burning dry wood in modern wood stoves, the emissions are right. not really a problem because right. everybody works on incentives. So the incentive mm-hmm. if I make a wood stove is to make the most efficient wood stove I can so I can outsell my competition. So you'll buy my wood stove.
Yeah.
And modern wood stoves are not the, you know, $200 Cabela's tent stove when somebody put one in their house. These are incredibly efficient.
They're incredibly efficient. They're incredibly expensive as well. You know, like I was going to try to put in a wood stove in my house that's in downtown and, you know, ignorant to me, you know, it's not allowed anymore. And I already bought the wood stove, you know, and it was an older one and I got a good deal, like for $100, you know, I got
yeah.
And they're like, oh no, you need these new. I'm looking up the prices. Like they're like $3,000
for
these stoves. Not to mention the pipes. Pipes are like the most expensive part of these things. It's insane. Who's got the monopoly on that one?
Yeah.
I am like, what?
Yeah, those insulated chimney pipe. That shit is ridiculous.
It's insane.
Like $100 a foot or some shit.
No, but you're right. I mean, I guess what I was pushing for is like we could even have these in like the cities where they would think that the smog is an issue, but you know a little bit more of an issue or the insurance would be an issue or something like that.
Yeah.
We're using less wood. It's a lot less hot when it comes out of the chimney. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of degrees cooler. So all these ideas of it being a danger have, you know, are not really a thing. So there's a lot of different things we can do, but I think even companies like PG&E might have incentive to want to do these kind of systems because, again, they need less people using energy now. At this point, they're actually at a point where it's like we can't keep up. And to be, you know, there's that entropy of like keeping up with demand and, you know, and then, you know, efficiency. Like if you can't continue to provide good power, you know, if it's constantly going up and down, people are going to be going another direction anyways. So I think even companies like that, I think insurance companies, energy companies are actually going to be the ones that we can use to be proponents of a lot of this stuff.
Well, they do have the incentive, right? That's the word that we keep coming back to. They're the ones that have the incentive to change this because they're the ones that end up paying for all this shit. Right. And, you know, as long as they don't have to pay claims, they don't really care. But they're fixing the, you know, some of these insurance companies may be begging for a bailout pretty quick here.
They're going to be belly up after this. And yeah, and they'll do something, you know, right. And then, you know, they'll ask for a bailout here and it just will be the same things continuing. But I hope, you know, I am hopeful that there is this entropy that's happening right now. It's gotten so bad, you know, and there's so much loss. There's got to be some changes, and it's going to come from within. I think at this point you could keep on, oh, we're going to not provide insurance to these areas. But now it's like so much of California is, you know, they can't provide insurance for it. So what are they going to do? And the state can't afford it under the California FAIR plans and stuff. It's just not going to happen. Back to, you know, it's what you were saying before with, you know, the incentives too. I actually have been drafting this idea, which is essentially the idea of, you know, it's not people being removed from the forest, you know, that needs to happen. It's actually we need more people doing the right things going back into these areas. Because, you know, in grazing, there's a bunch of prescriptions that could happen. Grazing is a big one. You know, once you masticate, or right after a fire, you bring in grazers at the right point of time. You can bring in the goats for a couple years, or even just a year or so if it's the right kind of burn, and you can bring sheep in right after that. So there's massive grazing incentives. It's working really well. In fact, we have some case studies here. Me and my partner were working on, holistic grazing and for fire here. And she did a grazing for this couple. And literally like a month after she went through this property, the fire came and stopped right where they were working, where the goats were. And so that was – we got all the documentation on that. It really works. And then all the other, you know, ag forestry, there's so many other prescriptions that can happen up in these forests, but, you know, you need to kind of have a different group of people, like some permaculture designers or something, you know, come out into these forest lands and come up with different, potential zoning, that could take place. And the idea that I have was like sort of a combination of the old Mining Claim Act, idea. And like a hybrid with the, which many could argue is not, wasn't a great thing, is the Homesteading Act, but, which cause it, you know, did a lot of negative things. But, the idea that showing value on land could then give you, some kind of a ownership. In this case, I think I like the Mining Claim Act sort of idea. You can lease land for super cheap. And you can do a certain amount of things on that land. So Imagine all these young people that can't afford being in the cities and things like that now have this opportunity. Oh, wow. Like, you know, you can get this lease and you could do all these different things. You could have, you know, animals grazing. You could do ag forestry. You could do all these different practices up in the mountains. And then you could have a spot to stay. Then you get a 5-year lease. Then you get a 10-year lease. You know, you could eventually maybe even own.
Change the incentives, right?
Change the incentive.
The longer you do well, the longer you can keep doing what you want to do, right?
Right.
And I think there'd be a place for, like, if you do this, if you take care of this long enough, it becomes yours.
Right. I think so. And I think that, you know, I mean, the forestry, we can't afford to manage these forests anymore.
No.
They need, again, that mimicry. We need that biomimicry in these places. And there needs to be a yield to have the biomimicry. So, again, so many different industries that could pop out of that. So many communities could be built out of that. I think it would actually help the wildlife too, in the long run, big time. You know,
you want to see deer go to a well managed suburb with large lots in Pennsylvania because they're an edge species. So what do you get when you tuck a suburb back into the wilderness, so to say, and you manage it well? You end up with shit tons of edge.
Right.
And everything goes to abundance on an edge. You know, sometimes we don't see the edge. I use bait fish to explain that. Like, you'd be out in the middle of the lake and somebody's catching fish there and it doesn't look like there's any edge. You're away from shore, but there's a hump underneath there and there's plankton blew up on it. And then that created a plankton cloud and that bought the bait fish. And then the white bass came. Like, there's an edge somewhere when you find abundance and you're extending edge. And that can be good or bad.
Right.
Because sometimes abundance, like pan oak, can be a bad abundance, right? It has to be a balanced abundance. But I've seen a lot work out. The problem is, like, everything we're talking about is actually being fought from the powers that be. So we talk about what to do with all this wood. Well, they don't want anybody burning wood at all.
Right.
So wait a minute. Like, okay, trust me, bro. Sooner or later, it's going to burn. It can burn in Bill's high efficiency wood stove, or it can burn in the forest. And it would probably be better if we did something else with it. I think there, you know, one of the things we could do is talk about, is there any legal structures that can be created that maybe give people more autonomy or capability, or maybe have more way to push in the existing system? I mean, politics is not my world. I don't think I've talked to an elected official that represents me since the 90s. I'm more of a renegade anarchist, but I also understand that that is a mechanism that can be utilized.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, the one that we came up with is some of the post-fire cleanup strategies, obviously, and that I can share with anybody who's going through this post-fire. It was a lot of work to get some of that. We have strategies to help, you know, get in to talk to these, get into these community meetings, get into these local councils to communicate. There's a lot of documentation out there of places where these different things work already. I mean, Brad Lancaster's work is incredible. You know, the guy that drylands, rainwater harvesting for drylands.
Yep.
All of his work, you know, is well documented. So, like, taking what people have already done and bringing those to local municipalities to you know, get approved is massive. But I can't really answer that question very well because, like, I feel you on the same. I'm in the same way. This program that I just mentioned, I think is probably would be one of the best hopes that we have. And I only think that some of these things I'm mentioning are right on the forefront of being possible due to the fact that the losses have been so massive. And that, you know, their ears are starting to open up. I think when you have events like LA where it's all over the news, and people who don't typically deal with disasters are starting to feel the pain of it, you know, people that have money, people that, you know, you see disaster stuff all the time, but when people that have money, people that actually could make change, that have a voice, you know, there is starting to be some possibilities. I really think that's true. So if we get ready with these kind of plans, these programs, You know, I think the Forest Service, many other groups are going to start to go, yeah, we do. We don't have the funds to do this. You know, we need some other opportunity, you know, opportunities. And if you design it right, you know, you have to sort of curtail the extreme environmentalists a little bit. Of course, in California, you know, so I think leading in the right way, I'm like what I do here locally, cause I'm in a very conservative, environment here. I, you know, I'm able to see both sides of the spectrum really well. In fact, nobody really knows, like, people that are really liberal think I'm liberal, and the people that are conservative think I'm conservative, because yeah. I don't really talk politics when it comes to my work. You know, I'm about doing the right thing, you know, getting the job done. And so I just speak in different languages to these different people, a little bit, but we're doing the same thing. Where do we have in common? We love the land. Whether it's you love the land because you want to have more hunting and fishing and, have freedom and you're in the mountain, you know, in the hills or whatever, or whether it's because, you know, you want just, you know, the, pristine environment and, wildlife or whatever it is. We all need clean, fresh water. We all want good, healthy food to eat. You know, we all want, there's some things that we all align on right. in this. And that's where I feel like there's this huge win there. And if we just focus on that, we focus on jobs, we focus on, you know, bringing up the communities, creating more, a better economy locally. I mean, I think this is the way forward. It's the only thing we can do, really.
So what have you observed, maybe other places, like maybe in Europe or something, where they have drastically different practices that work better? You know, like if I was going to do that, I would say we probably shouldn't do what Australia does, because they seem to do a lot of what we do. Mm-hmm. But if I think of Mediterranean climates, which is at least the area we're talking about with fires right now, yeah. you know, Spain, mm-hmm. Italy, European Union countries have a lot of very similar ecosystems. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they don't have any forest fires or anything. I'm just saying I haven't heard about this level of catastrophe in those areas. Maybe I missed it, but do they do things differently, and do they do some things we can learn from?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff, the degradation, like the big events happened a long, long time ago, in those areas. But, yeah. So number one is they call their forests woodland. Okay. And they have a woodland management practice, and it's much different than our practices. You know, they logged their trees a long time ago. That's okay. part of it. Right. Yeah. And, they don't have the same kind of forests like we do here in California. It's more like back east. Right. So it's definitely more hardwood driven, forests. But guess what? Even our forests here were predominantly deciduous trees back in the day. So, again, like, you know, having the policy – right now we have a U.S. Forestry Service, and I think it should be renamed personally, because it's not really forest. It's what most people think of this word forest. They think of this diverse, you know, kind of ecosystem, wildlife, and all this stuff. What we actually should call it is, you know, timber orchards. You know, because that's really what it is. It's run by, if people don't realize this, it's run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Okay. These are timber orchards, right? And we're managing them like orchards. And so that's, we have to create, it's because there's an incentive. There's a, like we keep saying, there's an incentive for the timber. It's a simple system, and it's one-sided. But now that the fires are getting so big, even the timber is not viable for harvest. So it's the economic incentives aren't really great. And so we need to have other products. And so Europe's really good at that. They have an incredible woodland management, and it's mom and pop. It's smaller scale, you know, local people coming in and getting these things. They have wood mills doing furniture, doing all kinds of products. You know, again, firewood and all these other things, if we can get that going, but there's a lot of products that can come out of the forest. There's more, you know, and if they're a place that's more diverse, that means there's more hunting, there's more, and if they're not burning and they're not terrible to be in. You've got recreation. You've got so many other things.
And then what do people protect? People protect what they love.
Right.
People protect what they value. Like right now, it is much harder to be a poacher in Africa than it used to be 30 years ago. One, because a lot of these countries started hiring rangers, are told, you see a poacher, shoot his ass. That will make you recalculate your risk reward. But the other side of it is you're a lot more likely to get ratted out by others because they've started, you know, taking the money that comes from the hunting permits and investing it in to the people's lives. And so the people look at the game and say, wait a minute. There's a lot of value to us in that thing. Mm-hmm. And everywhere you go and you increase the value to the population that actually lives in the place, they tend to get very, very protective of that particular area. The problem is you also have to then educate them to, well, yes, we should protect it, but this is how, because I'm gonna guess, based on people I talked to when I was out there, I was out in California about two years ago, it was in Mendocino. Very, very left-leaning, even that far away from the Bay Area. If you said, well, we should do these things in the forest, their first response is we should do nothing in the forest.
Right.
So you have to like align back to aligning the incentives, the love for the land with this is how you actually get. Like, I think I saw a lot of people like whatever they see now, if people aren't there, they think that's how it always was. You know, this conifer dominated system is not the way it was. Like huge stands, sure. Huge stands of redwoods and sequoias, sure. But that wasn't the dominant ecosystem everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the same thing, a person in a lot of places where a lot of mining was done in Pennsylvania, but it wasn't like right on a stripping hole or something. It wasn't destroyed with sulfur or zinc. And you have this young regrowth of these very scrubby trees, a lot of pine where pine normally wasn't because it can handle the acid that the oaks can't. They think, okay, that's good. We should never touch that again. Oh, no, that's really not like that used to be white oaks you couldn't get your arms around. It used to be chestnuts that 10 guys could link hands around. That's what it was. And if you want it wilderness or even managed woodlands, like you're saying, then it has to have that diversity come back.
Right. And where people are is other opportunities, right? You know, you have restaurants, you have, you know, little shops that pop up and things like that. I mean, I think, you know, the idea that nature was untouched, and I, you know, going back to what I was saying before is like, I do think that when things were healthy and there was, you know, this biodiversity and all these elements were in place before settlement. Yeah. Basically, you don't have to manage, you know, the vast amount. Yes, you could have that wild space. But unfortunately, I think we're at a point where we cannot heal any of these places without humans.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only way to heal it with humans is to have incentives that are in alignment with some of these regenerative values, because ultimately long term, like, and we know this, you know, that these things create more value overall. And I think, you know, the health values and things like that are finally starting to be talked about.
Yep.
You know, because everybody knows, you know, at least several family members that have some serious degenerative disease. Right. So, you know, we're starting to see the health values of being a really significant thing. The costs, I should say, of these health deficits are massive. So it's like, you know, all that put together. I mean, there's bigger things that have contributed to this. Obviously, like the economy overall is massive. So, you know, you can't fix everything. You know, locally, you do have to actually look at the bigger picture, too. When the prices of oil went up so high and transportation, that's when people stopped going into the forest. That's when, and then if you don't see the place that you're trying to value, it doesn't have any value. And so they closed over 1 million miles of forestry roads in the Plumas National Forest, where it's right here, over the last 10 years. a million miles. Why? Because people weren't using them.
Yeah.
They would set up those little boxes, you know, with the strip across, and yeah. they started to see the numbers. And they say, nope, close another one.
Why should we maintain a road that nobody's using? Which you can understand the mindset there. But mm-hmm. again, why are people not using it? Did you make it too expensive? Did you make it too hard? Did you make it too complicated? How many right. permits do I need to go camping? Right.
Right. Like, exactly.
And then modern culture has moved toward a very electronic, like we can't fix that. I think the other thing we have to look at is like, you keep talking about the way things were, and were is a big word because were 200 years ago, were before 1492,
right.
were before we lost all our megafauna during the end of the Younger Dryas, mm-hmm. right? Like, yes, before humans came here, we had massive herds of buffalo. We had four elk species that aren't even alive anymore.
Right.
Right? There's only like, I think there's two elk species left. There were six during first settlement. But North America lost something like 88%, I think is the number, somewhere in between 80 and 90% of its total megafauna. Yeah. And what occurred after the Younger Dryas ended with the melting and the end of the Ice Age. And, mm-hmm. you know, at one time they're blaming all the natives for killing them all, which anybody's driven across the country realizes is a ridiculous claim.
Right.
Like there's no way a bunch of people with spears and atlatls killed all these animals. They could have contributed to what was left of them, but there's no, it's not doable. It's not right. possible. They ran them off cliffs. You know, I've seen a few cliffs in this country, but there's a lot of places there ain't no damn cliffs, right? So like, that's not an explanation either. Something catastrophic occurred on the planet in that period of time, at least in certain geographies. And this area took it the worst. Where I lived in Pennsylvania when I was a kid, during the last ice age, there was 2 miles vertical ice over the house I grew up in. Like people can't get their the catastrophe created by that. We still live in the shadow of that. We'd like to believe that we don't.
Right.
And honestly, like you said, the natives didn't manage everything everywhere, but they managed a lot.
Yeah.
And they filled a lot of that niche. And what I'm really hearing you saying is on some level, we have to do that now.
Right.
Because the pig's not there, so you have to do the pig's job.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and you know, again, we got levels. We're talking about levels, but ultimately, like there is a evolutionary like process that has happened, you know, from the beginning of time, you know, and when it's on that natural sort of. There's all these fallback positions that come in nature, right? Fallback position, boom, boom, they kick into gear. Younger Dryas, massive fallback position, but there's still many, many elements that came in and filled in that gap. You know, I guess what I think is very significant over the last couple hundred years is the fact that, you know, it was sort of like it already was at critical level. I look at ecosystems as like a battery, and the life, in those ecosystems is like a charge of the battery, right? So yeah. We came with, you know, so they say before Younger Dryas, we had a full battery, let's say. And then, you know, then it was like down to here, still doing pretty good. You know how you, when you hit that 20% mark, you know, on your phone or whatever, then it starts to get pretty bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what happened is that those 200 years, we were already pretty low on that battery. And the last 200 years, we diminished it so much. We're really at those kind of that critical level,
that
right?
Critical
now.
Layer where the phone shuts itself off if you don't tell it not.
Yeah,
to.
It's like what I had said 10%, like literally 2 yeah. seconds ago.
But now it's 2.
Yeah, now it's like 2 and bye. So you know, I think it's a that's why I keep saying the compounding effect. You know, it's like yes, you know the brush, but now it's the brush without the biology. Without the grazers, without the critical ocean nutrients, without the shade, adding like massive openings in the forest. One of the presentations I did, I have a time lapse of Google Earth of Butte County and all the way to the Nevada desert, you know, and I show from 1987 to now, like all the change of how much the forest, and again, logging's not bad. It's about thoughtful, sector analysis kind of thinking is like we literally created by so much clear cutting. We literally created an opening of the high desert into the valley. And you can literally see that. And I'm actually compounding data. I've been working on this for a long time because it's not really easy to get all the different points. But the changes in the moisture level, the wind, and the temperatures and everything over a period of about 15, 20 years, the highest logging activity, the most kind of out of control clear cutting type of stuff happened literally right before the 10 years before the campfire in that area. So and it increased the winds, the vegetation, the desiccation mainly, because I'm a wild mushroom hunter.
Yeah.
And I love wild mushrooms. And I saw that happen right at that same time to where, and they're mostly mycorrhizal fungi. So, yeah. You know, the chanterelles, the morels, all these ones that I love to pick. And we just had massive die-off. And when I used to walk through the forest in the wintertime during the rains and everything, you'd be squish, squish, squish. And as the years went on, it was crunch, crunch, crunch. And to the point where you can't even walk through the forest because there's so much brush and everything. Nothing's breaking down. The diversity went completely away. So it's the compound, you know, we're at a critical mass right now. And unfortunately, it's only humans that can really actually bring it back to a point. But nature, pretty quickly, once you set the right conditions, as we all know, I've got more wildlife in my permaculture little third acre property downtown than a lot of places out in the wild, the open space nearby.
Yeah.
Because I've created that conditions and it brings in, it's like a magnet, you know, it brings in that life. So
we're literally going back about 380 million years in what we're doing by ruining the ecology here. And here's what I mean. As I was developing the syllabus for this course I'm about to put out, and I decided to put the fire cycle in, it occurred to me that I'd heard in other lectures that there was a time when if a tree fell, it didn't rot. There was no fungi, and there was no lignin-consuming bacteria. So I went down a rabbit hole. Well, how did that happen? The first forests emerged about 380 to 360 million years ago. That's their best estimate. The lignin-consuming bacteria and fungi began to emerge about 300 million years. That means we went about 80 million years. If a tree fell, it didn't rot. It either was fossilized, turned into coal, or it burned. Mm-hmm. And that means that this phenomenon existed. Our entire existence as humans is about 3% of that time. That's how long the forest was. And what I just heard you say is basically we're eliminating the very functional life forms that actually rot the wood that falls. Mm-hmm. And based on all my research and work that I've done with ag and knowing what that does for soils and their ability to retain liquid, you look at that and go, this is so blatantly obvious what the problem is. And it is so frustrating because on one level, you're like, why can't we just explain this to these morons that are in charge so that they'll stop being morons and fix the problem? The other side of it is I'm in my 50s. I have a passion for this, and I think about how long it took for me to learn what I know. And I realized the boulder you're trying to shove uphill here is insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially when that knowledge is not just lacking, but there is no interest in acquiring it. Because mm-hmm. we're back to incentives. So what does Gavin Newsom want to do? Get reelected or become president someday?
Mm-hmm.
Get in somebody's cabinet, right? This doesn't help him get there.
Mm-hmm.
Because politicians are judged on what they did in the last 3 weeks, basically.
Right.
This is not a short, like, no matter what we do, this is not short term.
Right.
This is a long term. You have to have that. I'm concerned about my great great grandchild's life mindset, and not because you put it in a political speech. You have to actually care.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of people that care on the surface, but when it goes in deep, they don't, because it's more like I would like to care, but I can't because I have to get by. Like, we've created this get by society. You know, I don't really know what we do other than those of us that know should work with what we do control and make our land, our communities as resilient as we can.
And that's exactly what I was going to say is that, you know, going back to, you know, the permaculture mindset is like what you do for yourself, for your own selfish reasons, right, is really the best thing that we can all do. Like when I got into this, the whole ecosystem restoration camps and the movement and like, you know, thinking about these large scale things. I mean, John Liu's whole thing was like the lowest plateau, 650,000 square kilometer restoration project, you know, and I'm looking at these woods and it's really easy. It's a really tempting thing to try to think big scale and, oh, let's think about these big systems. And it's important to do. Like we always have to keep part of our, you know, part of our mind out there and reaching out to these bigger ideas. But ultimately, like coming full circle back to, you know what I'm doing on my own land for myself and my neighbors and my family, you know, is actually the most powerful thing that I can do because you're going to lead through examples. So, you know, everybody that does this work is actually creating a demonstration site, is creating a place for at least their neighbors to see it, work in the gray areas, you know, continue to work in the gray areas, you know, don't go too crazy to piss off the, you know, but some of us do need to go crazy and piss off the authorities and so that they listen. I mean, when I brought people into my property in downtown Oroville, when they were doing certain inspections on my house for, you know, permits that I got, you know, I was like, come check this out. Cause I mean, I was kind of bold in at the time, like, and I was showing, you know, the earthworks and the water harvesting and all this stuff. And I was like, it's now or never, you know, I might as well show the guy, he's going to see it, you know, when he's here. And I go, well, and he's like, this is amazing. You know, like I've never even seen anything like this. And, you know, and I was like, well, you know, am I good? He's like, I think so. You know, like, you know, they didn't even really know. And I, next thing I know, I got a consult by that inspector to his house to do it, you know, and I've invited.
Doing it right. You know, when the bureaucrat says, come help me.
And I've been doing that with the school, you know, which has the most, I'm a K-8 school guard. I have a permaculture project at a local school. And when we do big tours, I invite, you know, strategically certain, you know, people from the county and other people that have – I try to combine two different groups, somebody that's really smart in the academic world and that already kind of knows about what I do and supports it. And then I invite the, you know, the more the lawmaker person, local code person, and they're like kind of like they have a group – there's a group – mentality there, like, you know, so all these people are like, this is great, you know, and then instead of them being by themselves, they're going, oh, well, I don't know, you shouldn't do this or whatever. They're having to compete with all
these
other people
in the group are voters.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's been my sort of strategic way to do a lot of the stuff that I do.
Yeah.
Is I sort of intimidate them in a way
to
say, like, you know, here's your constituents right here. And this is common sense shit like that.
And they like it, by the way.
And they actually do, you know, and by themselves is a lot better than when it's a group of them together. Yeah. I've noticed that and many times. So you can.
A group of people, but only one lawmaker.
Yeah, exactly.
Or one bureaucrat. Because that way they're outnumbered. Because what they always do is tell you, but what people want. And but there's the people.
Right.
There's the people. Like the whole angle on this, it makes me think of another thing I picked up from Seth. We did a big project up in Montana, and one of the people was like, well, I want a pond, but I can't have one for whatever reason. And he said, are you allowed to scrape topsoil from one place and put it somewhere else? And they said, yeah, we can do that. And, you know, he's like, well, how deep is your topsoil? And where they had like a foot. He's like, well, go to a low spot. There's probably more than a foot of topsoil there. Scrape all the topsoil and go do something good with it. take your excavator, put the bucket down and compact the ground. And he's always on pigs, right? Put the pigs in there. Mm-hmm. He said it will form a natural pond in time. And when the bureaucrat asks you where the pond came from, you say, I don't know. It just kind of showed up. We didn't build it. And then they'll tell you it's a wetland and you're required to protect it.
Yeah.
Right. And it was just let's reverse engineer the problem into the solution. And you got to be careful with that. Or, you know, as Jeff Lawton says, the solution can become the problem if you're not careful. But it is that kind of mindset of, like, instead of about this idea about asking for forgiveness instead of permission, create a situation that the bureaucrat is afraid to touch. Right. Like I'm sure you're familiar, being from California, with Ron Finley, you know, and all his guerrilla garden work down in like South Central and all. And, you know, they're not going to tear those gardens out when all of these people start to have community around these gardens, because you don't look very good. Like, one of the biggest weaknesses politicians have is they don't want to look stupid to their voters. They don't care about looking stupid to the people that will never vote for them anyway. Right. But they never want to look stupid to the people that actually give them power. And that can be leveraged against them. You just have a different creative way. You have a very friendly way of doing it. Like, here's a bunch of people that voted for you. Here's an academic that you respect. Right. Here's me, and I'm going to give you a tour of my property while you're here.
I invited you. It wasn't from a bad thing. It's like you got to initiate. You know, like, Leah, if you're running from the law, you better turn yourself in, you know. You know, you get points for that or something.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
All these talk about bureaucrats make me have to use the restroom. Do you mind if I take a quick
one? Can we just real quick, you tell everybody how they can find out more about you, and I'll close while you do that?
Okay. I don't want to end that way. But, hey, thank you for having me again, man. I'm always, like, blown away. I didn't know a lot about you, honestly, like for a couple months ago, and, you know, very well rounded. It's like, I can't imagine all the stuff that you keep in your head. It's amazing. I think a well rounded person is probably my biggest, mark for a human being. So, you know, I think what you're doing is amazing. Thanks, everybody, for listening. My name is Matthew Trum. Once again, treetoppermaculture.org is my website. You can treetoppermaculture@gmail.com if you want to reach out to me. And you can just search my name, Matthew Trum. You can find everything about me on there.
Well, and I tell people they should definitely get by and check out your site. And I'll make sure all the links that you sent with me are in the show notes. And if you want to excuse yourself now, you can. I'll go ahead and close.
Yeah, I do consultations, and now I have my contractor's license, I can implement these things now. So that's been what I've been focused on. I'm super focused on school garden programs right now, I'm creating this regenerative industry pathway program. So if you're a person that's interested in something with school gardens, that's something I'm really, really focusing on right now, and love to help you get something set up in your area. So, yeah.
All right, Matthew. Well, thank you for being with us. It's been a great discussion.
Thanks, Jack. I'd like to talk to you in a minute here, but
yeah, I'll be here.
Awesome. All right, y'all.
All right, folks, real quick, I'll close up. That was a great discussion. And I was just asked if he was part of Our Soil with Matt Powers. And I don't remember seeing him there. I didn't go watch all of the stuff in the latest one that I was part of. Probably should, but I don't think so. But I'm going to definitely introduce him and Matt, because I think he's definitely the kind of person we want speaking at events like that. I'll probably introduce him to John Bush as well, because he seems like a great guy. He's new to me. I just found out about him when his app came in, but I really like what he's doing. And yeah, I said it was prior to this. I'm looking at the note sheet right now. He submitted his application December 14th. So if you've been thinking about getting on the show, but you're going to get ready, you want to put in a guest app, I would do that. I think right now we're booking at the end of March. So I get that a lot of times. And then people are like, I got something coming out next week. Can I get on the air? It's like in 2.5 months. So, yeah, that's just a little heads up there. And we kind of wane on our guest submissions at the end of the year. So that's actually about as good as it gets, as you're applying in December 14th. And getting on the air a month later, January 15th. Anyway, as we wrap up today, I want to remind you guys about a couple things. One is how you can support this show. And a really great way to do that is become a member of my members support brigade. If you do that, you'll help us out with about 18.3 cents an episode is how the math works out based on how many episodes I do a year. You'll get discounts on a lot of things that will more than pay for itself. And I really appreciate every one of you that's ever been a member, and I probably don't push it as much as I should. Like I used to push it every episode, and now I probably push it maybe once every 2 weeks. But it really helps you guys that join the members brigade. And again, if you actually use the discounts I've negotiated, it won't, in the end, it will not cost you money. I hear from people all the time that say they put $300-$500 a year back in their pocket by being a member. Next up, though, is you can also do your shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's where they're all products that I've reviewed that I recommend. I've actually used them myself. If I wouldn't spend my money on it, I wouldn't tell you to. I was thinking about what to run today, and I'm running these little 2-inch nursery pots. You get like 100 of them for about $20. They're fantastic. I won't go deep into them since the show was long today, but I am using them now for the second season as I'm getting ready to start all my plants for this spring, because that's only like 12 weeks away right now. So I'm not planting yet, but I'm getting everything in order. And it's time to start thinking about that. These are really space conscious, yet they're big enough to actually give you a good root formation. And last year I ran 2 cycles of starts. So you could think of it like they've been through 2 seasons. They're still like brand new. I'm not saying they're going to last 10 years. I don't know that, but they're fantastic. If you want my reasoning for them, just read the write-up today again, but start thinking about if you're going to start your own plants for your gardens this year, if you're going to do it indoors and you need lighting, start thinking about that now. The place you're going to do it, if you're going to make your own potting soil, what you're going to make it out of, or you're going to buy it, what you're going to get. If you're going to use mycorrhizal inoculation, I have a product I recommend at tspaz.com. You can check that out as well. There's a lot of different things to think about so that you're not trying to do this when it's already too late to do it. The other thing real quick, is the item of the day from yesterday. I want to reiterate these stabilizers, slip-on ice cleats. You know, we got another one rolling in. It's going to be 16 degrees Monday morning. I don't think we're going to get precip, but we might. As I said yesterday, this is a real prepper item. There's 5 places people tend to hurt themselves when they fall on ice. Number 1 is the ankle. That's very mobility limiting. Number 2 is the knee. Also mobility limiting, and during a time when there's ice and snow down. Better to have these before, not after you do that. The next one is your back. Anybody that's ever hurt their back knows, even if it's not life-altering, it doesn't require surgery. You might not be moving. You might not be moving for a while, okay? When a back injury is extremely limiting. The next one is the arms, and it's usually like shattered elbows, broken arms, broken wrists, bad shit. And the 5th one, you know what it is. It's the cabeza, man. It's the head. Just like the story I told yesterday, I am so lucky that wasn't a serious injury. If not this product, if not from Amazon, I do not care. If you live where you have to deal with ice and you go outside in it, you need something like this. And the older you get, the more that's true. With that, tomorrow, expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Friday flashback, and we do it all again. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with another episode. And Homesteading Heathen, thank you for that super sticker right there at the end.
They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.